ready to explore some biblical prophecy. We're going deep into Daniel, chapters 2 and 7.
Oh, yeah, those are fascinating.
They are. And we've got a great guy today, this lecture transcript by Robert Vannoy. He was a real expert.
I've heard of him, yeah. So what are we focusing on in these chapters?
Well, it's all about Nebuchadnezzar's dream and those four beasts.
Oh, right, the ones that symbolize the kingdoms?
Exactly. So picture this. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, powerful guy. He wakes up in a cold sweat, had this super intense dream. Problem is, he can't remember it.
Oh, I hate when that happens.
Right. And this isn't just any dream. This thing shook him up.
So what'd he do?
He calls in all his advisors. You know, the wise men, the magicians, the whole mystical crew.
Trying to jog his memory.
Not quite. He demands they tell him what he dreamt. And then, the kicker, he wants them to interpret it too.
Whoa, hold on. How can they interpret a dream he can't remember?
That's the impossible task he gives them.
Talk about pressure.
Oh, big time. Failure means death.
Yikes. So, what happens? They pull a blank.
That's where Daniel steps in. He gets divine help. Reveals the dream to Nebuchadnezzar.
Okay, so what was this crazy dream about?
A giant statue. Head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron.
Wow. Sounds impressive.
Wait, there's more. The feet, they were iron mixed with clay.
Interesting combination. What happens next?
Out of nowhere, a rock. Not made by human hands, mind you. This rock smashes the statue's feet. The whole thing crumbles to dust.
Powerful image. That must have freaked Nebuchadnezzar out.
Oh, for sure. So Daniel steps up to interpret it.
Lay it on me.
The statue. It's four kingdoms. Starting with Babylon, the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar's own kingdom.
Makes sense. What about the other three?
That's where things get interesting. Three more kingdoms will come, each weaker than the last, until, bam, God's kingdom comes along, symbolized by that rock, wipes them all out, and rules forever.
Okay, so the big picture is clear. God's kingdom wins. But what about those other three kingdoms? Which ones are they?
That's the mystery Vannoy dives into. He presents three main ways to look at it. He calls them the critical approach, the first advent of Christ, and the second advent of Christ.
Three different takes. This should be good.
It is. And they're all fascinating in their own way.
Okay, let's hear them. Where does the critical approach start?
Well, it focuses on when the rock smashes the statue, the climax. This view ties it to a Jewish uprising against this guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, around 165 BC.
Antiochus Epiphanes, wasn't he the one known for persecuting the Jews?
The very same. So this interpretation kind of sees the rock as representing the Jewish people rising up.
Interesting. But hang on, didn't Babylon fall to the Persians? Where does this Antiochus guy fit in?
Yeah, that's one of the tricky parts. This view relies on there being a Median kingdom between the Babylonians and the Persians.
A Median kingdom.
Right. But there's not much historical evidence for it.
Some kind of shaky.
Yeah, Vannoy even quotes this scholar, N.W. Porteous. He straight up calls it a historical blunder.
Ouch! So that's a big problem for the critical approach, then.
Yep. It's a challenge, that's for sure. But the folks who support this view say, you got to understand the book of Daniel and its historical context, even if some details don't line up perfectly with what we know now.
I see their point. But I'm ready to hear about the next interpretation, the first advent of Christ. What's that about?
So this one ditches the whole Median kingdom idea.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
It sticks with the empires we know about. Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Greek, and Roman. But here, the rock, it represents Christ's first coming, you know, when Jesus was born.
I see. And it says the spiritual kingdom is established during the Roman Empire?
Precisely.
That seems to fit better historically, but didn't the Roman Empire last way longer than those other empires?
Yeah, much longer. And that's a point Vannoy brings up. If the rock is Christ's first coming, which happened pretty early in the Roman Empire, it makes the Roman part of the timeline feel really stretched out compared to the others.
I can see that. So that leads us to the third interpretation, right? The second advent of Christ.
You got it. Second advent, that's the belief that Jesus will return.
Right, the second coming.
This view keeps the same four kingdoms as the last one. But it says the Roman Empire's got two phases.
Two phases. Interesting. So like the legs of iron are one phase and the feet, the iron and clay, that's another phase.
Exactly. And there's a gap in between. So the rock smashing the statue, that's Christ's second coming at the end of that second phase.
Okay, I'm following. But creating that gap in the Roman Empire, wouldn't that kind of mess up the whole four kingdom parallel? I mean, the other chapters in Daniel seem to present them as pretty straightforward.
That's what Vannoy points out. It might feel a bit artificial to force that gap in there.
So we've got three interpretations, each with its own strengths and weaknesses. This is why I love studying prophecy. It's like a puzzle.
It definitely keeps you thinking. But before we get lost in the weeds here, let's switch gears to Daniel 7.
Chapter 7, huh? What's waiting for us there?
Well, Vannoy suggests looking at both chapters together. He thinks it might help clear up some of these tricky interpretation issues.
Makes sense. Two pieces of the same puzzle. Let's see what we find. And it's like, we've got these two puzzle pieces and we got to figure out how they fit together. So Daniel 7, huh? What are we dealing with here?
Four beasts this time. Each one symbolizes a kingdom, just like the statue.
Okay, bring on the beasts. What do we have?
First up, a lion with eagle's wings.
Sounds majestic.
Right. And most scholars agree this one's Babylon. Strong, powerful, like a lion.
Okay, I can see that. What's next?
A bear. But get this, it's raised up on one side.
That's a bit odd. What's the significance of that?
Well, this one probably represents the Medo-Persian Empire. Remember, it was two parts, the Medes and the Persians. So that raised upside, it could mean one part was more dominant.
The Persians, right. They are the ones who really took over.
Exactly. Okay, ready for beast number three.
Hit me with it.
A leopard, but not just any leopard. This one has four wings and four heads.
Whoa, that's a lot going on. Four wings and four heads. What's that all about?
Well, this one's usually connected to the Greek Empire. Leopards. They're known for being fast and agile, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of like how Alexander the Great conquered all that territory.
Yeah, he moved pretty quickly. And I'm guessing those four wings and four heads have something to do with what happened after he died.
You got it. His empire was divided among his four generals. So four wings, four heads, four generals, four parts of the empire.
Clever. Okay, that leaves us with beast number four. What's this one like?
This is where it gets a bit scary. A beast with iron teeth and 10 horns.
Whoa, iron teeth. That sounds pretty menacing. And didn't the statue have iron legs?
You're catching on. Yeah, the iron is definitely a connection back to the statue. So this fourth beast, it points to the Roman Empire.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah.
But what about those 10 horns? What are they all about?
That's a great question. And this is where we get into some really fascinating stuff. Those 10 horns, they're usually interpreted as 10 kings or kingdoms that come out of the Roman Empire.
10 kings or kingdoms. So is this like the Roman Empire breaking apart?
That's one way to think about it. And remember that little horn we talked about before?
It's the one that comes up in the lecture. Yeah, I remember. What was it? Like a horn that comes out of one of the other horns?
Exactly. Well, this little horn, it shows up here in Daniel 7, comes up among those 10 horns.
Okay, and what's so special about this little horn? Why does it get so much attention?
Well, it does some pretty crazy stuff. It uproots three of the other horns, for one thing. And it's described as having eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully.
Eyes like a man and a boastful mouth. That sounds almost human, like a person.
It does, doesn't it? And a lot of scholars, they think this little horn is connected to the Antichrist. You know, that figure in biblical prophecy that's supposed to appear in the end times.
Oh, yeah, the Antichrist. The one who's supposed to persecute God's people and try to set himself up as some kind of ruler.
That's the one. So here we've got these two parallel visions, the statue and the four beasts, both pointing to these kingdoms that lead up to the Roman Empire. And then we have this little horn, potentially the Antichrist, popping up somewhere in that Roman Empire timeline.
This is giving me a lot to think about. It's like the plot of a movie, but it's real.
It is intense, isn't it?
Yeah.
So let's try and connect this back to those different interpretations of the rock smashing the statue. Like, if we go with the First Advent view, where the rock is Christ's first coming, what happens to the timing of the Antichrist? When does he show up in that scenario?
That's a good question. If the final battle already happened, at least symbolically, back when Christ came the first time.
Right. Then where does that leave the Antichrist?
Well, people who like the First Advent interpretation, they often say the little horn isn't the Antichrist, or at least not the Antichrist as we traditionally think of him. They say it could be someone like Antiochus Epiphanes, the guy who persecuted the Jews, someone who already came and went.
So they're kind of blending the critical approach with the First Advent view. But doesn't that mean it's all over? If the rock is Christ's first coming and the little horn's a figure from the past, then the big showdown's already happened.
Yeah, that's a big point of debate. Some folks say the final victory's already happened, at least spiritually, through Christ's death and resurrection. But others say, hold on, we're still waiting for God's kingdom to fully arrive, that time when evil is totally defeated and God's in charge of everything.
Okay, so the First Advent view has some wrinkles to iron out. But what about the Second Advent view? How do they handle the little horn?
Well, if they're saying Christ comes back later than the little horn.
It has to be someone who comes before that, right?
Exactly. For them, the little horn would show up in the future, maybe during that gap between the two phases of the Roman Empire. So Christ's second coming, that's the rock smashing the statue, would come after the little horn does his thing.
So they're sticking with a more literal view of end times prophecy. This little horn's a powerful, deceitful figure, leads a rebellion against God, and then, bam, the final showdown when Christ returns.
That's how they see it. Two very different interpretations, each with its own implications for how we understand prophecy. It's wild how one little detail can lead to such different conclusions.
It is fascinating, isn't it? Oh, there's one more thing about the little horn that I thought was really interesting. Remember how it's described in chapter 7? It talks about it speaking boastfully and persecuting God's people.
Right. What about it?
Well, some scholars have connected that to the whole idea of empire, like how empires throughout history, they've used propaganda and violence to control people and silence anyone who disagrees with them.
So they're saying the little horn might not just be a single person, it could be like a system or an ideology.
Exactly. It's like the spirit of empire, this tendency toward domination that's been around forever. And if that's what the little horn represents, then we're not just waiting for one guy to show up. We need to be paying attention to how this spirit of empire is at work in the world right now.
Wow. That's a chilling thought, but it makes you think power dynamics, they're everywhere.
They are. It's like a warning to be on guard, to recognize how power can be abused, and to resist any system or ideology that tries to put itself above God. It's wild how these ancient prophecies can still make you think today.
They really do.
We've covered a lot of ground here. That statue in Daniel 2, the four beasts in Daniel 7,
Yeah.
three different ways to interpret those four kingdoms. And then, of course, that mysterious little horn.
Yeah, we've been through quite a bit.
We have. And I think it's important to remember that interpreting prophecy, it's not always about finding a clear answer to every question.
You're right about that.
It's more about the journey. Exploring these texts, considering different viewpoints, letting those ancient words challenge us, shape how we see the world.
It's like a conversation, not a puzzle with only one solution.
Exactly. It's easy to get caught up in the details, trying to decode every symbol, trying to predict the future.
Right.
But maybe the real message is about how we live now, in light of what these prophecies tell us about God, his power, his plan.
That's a good point. It's about living with that bigger picture in mind.
So God's in control. He's working through history. And in the end, his kingdom wins.
That's the ultimate takeaway.
Knowing that should give us hope, even when things feel uncertain.
Absolutely. It's a reason to live with purpose, even in the midst of all the craziness.
It makes you wonder, though, how do we actually apply these ancient prophecies to our lives today? What does it mean to live in God's kingdom, knowing it's already here in some ways, but not fully here yet?
That's the question, isn't it?
It is.
Maybe it means realizing we're part of something bigger, a kingdom that goes beyond borders and political systems. It means living with hope, knowing God's working to make things right, even when we don't see it.
And maybe it means being aware of those dangers we talked about, that spirit of empire, that desire to dominate and control.
Right, that's a constant temptation.
We see it throughout history, and we see it today. So it's a call to resist that pull towards power, to stand up for what's right, to work for a world where everyone is treated with dignity and respect.
That's a powerful message, and it leaves us with a question for you, our listener. If Daniel's prophecies are unfolding in history, what does that mean for how you see the world today? What does it mean for your place in all of this?
That's something to think about. And as always, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the book of Daniel. Keep searching for truth and keep exploring. We'll see you next time.